Ed Tsukiyama has had an eventful life and a long one. At 96, he can look back on membership in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, wartime adventures in the jungles of Burma for the Military Intelligence Service, and a distinguished law career. His new memoir is called My Life's Journey, and he's with us in our studio. Good morning, Ted.
Hi. Morning.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
You've lived a lot of the modern history of Hawaii, it would seem.
Yeah, I guess.
You were. Let's take it to the war years. You were how old when the war broke out?
20.
20 years old.
20, yeah.
And what were your circumstances at the time?
I was a junior at the University of Hawaii.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. And were you in the ROTC unit there?
Yes.
So what was that like? What were your feelings when Pearl Harbor happened?
Well, I was in the ROTC, just as the name implies, Reserve Officer Training Corps. We're preparing to get a officer's commission to serve as an officer in the U.S. Armed Forces in the event of a war.
And then along comes Pearl Harbor. What?
Yeah, it hit when I was a junior at the university.
So what changed for you?
Oh, I think it changed for life, everyone's life.
Yeah.
War was entirely different.
Well, what happened to your ROTC unit, for example?
Well, that morning, we got called out. The ROTC was called out and was immediately converted into the Hawaii Territorial Guard.
Mm-hmm.
And that eventually I guess within a year's time, the War Department decided to form the now well-known 442nd Regiment.
Right.
So they called for Nisei volunteers. I remember they called for 1,500, and they got over 20,000 volunteers. They could have made 4 or 5 battalions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Where did that enthusiasm come from, do you think?
I don't think it's enthusiasm. I think it's just a natural response to respond to the country's need for service in times of emergency.
Sure. And yet, you know, the command structure of the military at the time wasn't at all sure about the loyalty of young Japanese Americans.
Not back in the Pentagon.
Uh-huh.
And that's why it took about a year before they finally came around to deciding that, I guess we can trust these guys to form a all-Nisei battalion and issued a call for volunteers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, they had a quota of 1,500.
Do you think they were surprised by the response, the command?
I don't know. I don't know if they were surprised, but I think, I think if it was publicized and made a campaign, they could have gotten many times more.
Gotten even more, huh?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
There's a passage in the book that really struck me, and it had to do with how you felt about the soldiers that you were fighting.
Mm-hmm.
The young soldiers of the Japanese Empire.
Mm-hmm.
And that before you saw them,
mm-hmm,
you had a lot of anger. You remember that?
Oh, yeah. Pearl Harbor Day, they made the sneak attack and attacked Hawaii, and we suffered a lot of casualties and all that.
Well, let me just read you a passage that struck me from the book, because you had said you had vowed on the day of the December 7th attack, I'm quoting now, that I would knock down the first Japanese soldier I met, smash his face. With all this as background, I was invited to inspect the Japanese POW camp. Entered the compound with a big chip on my shoulder, but instead of the arrogant fighting machine we had been taught to expect, I was greeted by a pathetic, fearful, dispirited group of young rural kids. And you said, any impulse I had to physically punish the prisoners quickly vanished. That must have been a surprising moment, yeah? They were just kids.
Yeah, from that Pearl Harbor day morning on, I vowed, you know, Japan was the enemy, and I'm going to retaliate and punish anyone that I could in retaliation.
And that was the feeling of your fellow?
I think so, yeah. I know, because this would impugn and challenge our loyalty.
Yeah.
And maybe there was a natural instinct that, hey, we got to show our true colors. And so, you know, like when they call for 1,500 volunteers, they got over 20,000.
You got over 20,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How did you end up in the military intelligence service?
Well, I was part of the group, you know, including Danny Noy, mm-hmm. and all them that volunteered and was accepted for the 442nd.
Mm-hmm.
So I was at Camp Shelby, so that was about 3,000 or the 3,500. But the military intelligence had a higher priority on Nisei, who had some knowledge or competence of the Japanese language.
Mm-hmm.
So they pulled out about 150 of us, I think,
mm-hmm.
and sent us to a special military intelligence training school.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at Camp Savage, Minnesota. So we got transferred from Mississippi to Minnesota from infantry to combat to military intelligence,
mm-hmm.
learning Japanese and fighting the Japanese with their own language.
So you had some Japanese, but you got trained in...
All of us, Nisei, before the war, our parents forced us to go to at least 1 hour every day. After everybody else was out through school at 2:30,
uh-huh.
we had to go to another school and spend at least an hour learning Japanese language and culture.
So... What were your duties in the MIS, in the Military Intelligence Service?
Well, there were various segments of intelligence that you know were needed, like directly interrogating Japanese prisoners or translating Japanese war diaries and stuff mm-hmm. like that. But I was assigned to the Air Force and had to put on a set of earphones and intercept Japanese fighter aircraft as they flew over China and Burma,
uh-huh.
and intercept what the pilots were yelling to their towers.
That had to be information that had to be turned around in seconds, I would think.
Well, the main thing was that we translate the Japanese into English and just send it upstairs. And I don't know what they did with that
yeah.
information, but we were the converters of the enemy communication.
Right. And you had to be pretty close to enemy lines to do that, didn't you, just to even...
No, fortunately, you know, it was radio intercept, so we were in some base... way in the back in the safe areas in the rear rear echelon, not up directly confronting the enemy, which was at that time in Burma.
Yeah,
and they were being chased out of Burma, and they were pushed into Thailand, and that's when the American Army from India, we were flown into Burma, mm-hmm. and then pushed the Japanese out into China.
For a long time, the Japanese were winning in that part of the world, weren't they?
Well, at that stage of the game, yeah, they were at the border. In fact, at one point, they entered India at a place called Imphal, mm-hmm. and so they had conquered and occupied Burma, and had invaded part of India.
After your service in the Second World War, you made your way back to Hawaii and were part of that whole sort of what happened in Hawaii after the Second World War, you know, I guess they'd call it the Democratic Revolution, really remade Hawaii society. What path did you take after you mustered out?
Well, at that time, my main objective was to continue my education, which was interrupted. Mm-hmm. I was a junior at university.
Right.
And I wanted, of all things, to get my degree and even go on into graduate school and law school,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I eventually did.
What made you want to become an attorney?
I think even before the war, I had aspirations.
Uh-huh. What did you do with that career? What did you do as an attorney?
I didn't do the bread and butter, going to court and all that stuff. And I ended up really in as an arbitrator.
Finding other ways to resolve disputes, yeah?
Yeah, this was to arbitrate disputes between the labor unions and the employers. Employer, oh. Yeah.
Of which there were many in Hawaii in the years after the war, right?
Yes, you know, they had their labor disputes.
Yeah.
And the arbitrator was a peacemaker.
Sure.
Called in from the outside to intervene and try to get the parties to.
And that became a big focus of your law career, didn't it? Mediation,
I became, I think I made my niche as an arbitrator.
Yeah. Yeah. What's the value of it? What's the value of arbitration?
Well, it fulfilled part of my personal, not ambitions, but, you know, I felt that resolving disputes, you know, a mediator, arbitrator gets in the middle, mostly between the unions and management, mm-hmm. and to get the disputing parties to resolve their differences and bring in this case stability and peace to the labor management environment.
That's not always easy, is it?
Well, fortunately, I think an arbitrator was sort of highly regarded, mm-hmm. and so there was a responsibility which you felt you had to carry out, and of course not abuse the authority, mm-hmm. but to use it to the best interests of dispute resolution and peace and stability in the labor management industry.
It's a good goal, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, this memoir is a memoir of a pretty good life. It seems as it's been a pretty good life, hasn't it?
Yeah, I haven't read it recently anyway. But let's see, Kaufman compiled that, huh?
Yeah, Tom Kaufman. Yeah. Well, I have read it, and it is quite a life. And I thank you very much for talking with us. Thanks for coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Ted Tsukiyama is the author of My Life's Journey from Watermark Publishing. He'll be signing copies this Sunday at 12:30 at United Methodist Church in Honolulu.